Okay, today's called a masterclass, and I will confess that we're making this up as we go, because none of us have done this before. But the tradition of a masterclass, of course, is very strong in the arts and music, sport, and some of you probably, as I have seen the kind of masterclasses some of the great artists like Pavarotti or Sutherland or Horn have carried out over, and that amazing footage of Maria Callas running a masterclass, where some poor novice singer gets to perform and then Pavarotti tells them all the things they're doing wrong. If you've never seen that, it's really is terrific, and there's plenty of footage on YouTube. We're not quite going that far today, which I think everyone would be relieved about. What we're really wanting to look at, though, is how can we take advantage of Kathy being here and extend our interaction with her, building on the looking at some real-life New South Wales vet resources. So we have two people who are going to present on behalf of their organisations in a moment. And it's partly about trying to ground the discussions in the kind of challenges that we all work with, but also not just about listening to Kathy tell us how to do it, but all of us being involved in a professional exchange that will help extend our learning, and maybe we can teach Kathy something to take home to the States as well. So, as I said, there's two speakers today, and the way we're going to run things is that they're each going to speak for about 10 minutes or so, and then I'll ask Kathy if she wants to respond to anything in particular that they've raised or has any comments about the overall presentations, and then we'll start with some questions around your reactions to what you've seen, comments you want to make, maybe questions you want to ask, but more about trying to talk with each other around what that means. We'll need to use the mics because things are being recorded, so we'll try and be speedy about moving the mics around. And try not to break up the flow. If you've got, as long as the key of the question's on the mic, the rest of it, the discussion doesn't really have to be. Mel probably won't like that, but we need to keep things moving and not have that stiltedness that's caused by having the microphone. Just before we start, though, I really do want to say that we've asked Kathy to be, you know, very open and honest with us, but not to feel that we're asking her to endorse or judge what's going on at all, but just, as I said, it's about all of us sharing professional experience and learning. So the first speaker today is Vijendra Lal from the New South Wales Centre for Learning Innovation. Vijendra is going to be followed by Richard Stubley from Open Learn. So we're having a presentation around provider to public education, and a presentation from private vet work. They'll be talking about their approach to e-learning, the kind of conceptual base for their work, and so on. So thank you, Vijendra.
Thanks, Karen. Hello, everybody. What I'll do this afternoon for the next 10 minutes is share with you how my organisation, the Centre for Learning Innovation, approaches learning design. I have in the audience a number of my learning designer colleagues, and hopefully if I have missed anything important, they'll be able to add to it in the discussions which follow. What I wanted to do was to quickly give you an overview of our organization and then go into looking at how we approach learning design. Also, I want to focus on some of the shifts we have been doing in our learning design approaches. And hopefully in the reflection and discussions we have later on, it would be good to see your reactions to some of those shifts.
Our organization, the Center for Learning Innovation, is part of the Department of New South Wales Education and Training. It was
set up in 2004 with twofold aims. Firstly, to foster innovation in teaching and learning across both schools and TAFE, and also to provide products and services to support teachers in debt as well as to external clients. In terms of the various services we perform and how much effort we give to those services, you'll see from the chart that 53% of our effort goes into designing multimedia-based e-learning resources.
I'll keep one down the back here.
There are about 150 of us, and we serve both TAFE and schools, and the vast majority of our effort is in designing innovative e-learning multimedia products. How do we do this? In terms of our design, taken out of a paper we did recently, we see learning design as a process of designing a learning experience for an identified group of learners to enable them to achieve a set of learning outcomes. And the learning outcomes we source from endorsed training packages in the vast majority of our cases. Our learning design approach is very much shaped by the context in which we operate and also by the needs of our target audience. In terms of the operational context, it's important to understand our approach by first understanding that we are a debt organization, and as such we have to do a certain amount of activities to support debt in its mission. Firstly, we need to implement debt initiatives which are out there to support technology-based learning. And recently, there have been some big funded initiatives like the Connected Classes Program and the Digital Education Revolution. And as part of that, where a lot of computers and software are being rolled out, our learning design and the resources and capability building we develop needs to support that. We are also expected to support debt education reforms like the TAFE in the 21st Century Reform Agenda, which came out 18 months ago, and the aim there is to enable TAFE to become more flexible and innovative in the use of e-learning technologies to support e-learning. We also work in line with debt guidelines regarding copyright, child protection, privacy, accessibility, interoperability, and so on. And that underpins some of the ways in which we go about designing our learning programs. We also expect it to be, as a government organization and taxpayer-funded, to be effective and efficient. And we also looked upon to be supporting innovative and quality teaching and learning. So that's our operational context. In terms of our clients whom we service, the overall profile is basically that 10 TAFE institutes spread across New South Wales, 130 colleges, 10,500 teachers, got 500,000 enrolments. Out of our those 500 enrolments, 91% of our students are part-time, and 56% of them are over 25 years of age. In terms of the needs of our clients, this is what we have gleaned from our interactions with them and the feedback they provide to us. Our clients tell us that they need learning resources to support e-learning, which utilize rich media skill-based assets instead of lots of text-based content, which we used to do in the past to support primarily distance education. They're also telling us that they want resources which can be easily used in a variety of learning environments, including technology-based learning environments, which use learning management systems like Moodle and Sakai. They're also telling us that they are not looking for quality in terms of high production values, but fitness for purpose, user-generated content, and so on. And they want, in this digital age, for resources to be completed within shorter time frames. They also want resources which can be easily customized and mixed and matched and further developed by them to suit a variety of learning needs. And they also want us to be able to utilize content they create and their students create, user-generated content. They also look to us for not only giving them completed e-learning resources, but also to help build capability in them to do some of their own development. So the challenge for us is, how can we not only give them resources, but give them templates, tools, wizards, and so on, to grow and extend those resources. And also, they want resources which are accessible, which can meet the needs of learners with all abilities.
resources which can work together with different technologies which are interoperable, and resources which can be easily found. Given we're a large organization, we have a fairly clearly articulated process which we follow to design learning resources, and this diagram attempts to capture that. We start off by identifying what the learning need is. We do an analysis of the target audience, the learning context, the learning objectives, and we come up with a design plan. And then in the development phase, we follow that plan, implement that plan, and come up with the resources. And there's, of course, the publishing, distribution, storage, and implementation and evaluation phases. All our processes are underpinned by various quality assurance mechanisms which we build along the way, and I won't go into too much detail there. In terms of our approach to learning design, we ensure that our learning design is underpinned by adult learning principles and constructivist approaches. If I were to summarize the approach we have taken in many of our resources, and the approach varies from resource to resource, largely our approach involves the following. We design authentic learning tasks and activities based on training package competencies. We develop learning content where it's needed for underpinning knowledge and so on. And, of course, we organize this content in line with good principles of online information design and learning design. We also provide appropriate support and scaffolding to our learners to be able to navigate through that learning experience. And we use a project team-based approach. In a typical project team, there'll be learning designers, multimedia specialists, teachers, and so on. So basically, we start off by looking at what the learning task is, as defined in the training package. We work out the best way to enable learners to achieve that task by giving them authentic activities set in simulated workplace settings. I've got a few examples here of products we've done recently and in the recent past. This is a project we've been working on this year, which is now complete. The Diploma in IT Project Management. Here we didn't create any content. All we did was we created a simulated a workplace called Four Phones Intranet, within which the students would be set tasks to be able to perform the learning activities which are needed of them. The content is all in a major textbook, so content is already out there. What we're providing is an authentic environment and appropriate tasks to guide them through the project management competencies. Another example we're working on, which should be finished end of this year, is in aged care, Diploma in Aged Care, and here we are building resources and activities around the simulated aged care center called Gravilia. Children's Services is a project we did a few years back, which we updated in the light of training package changes. And here, again, it's task-based. Various tasks and case studies are set into a simulated childcare center called Somerville, so that learners get authentic experiences working through those activities. We've also got content where content is needed, and we've placed them in such a way that learners have a choice in terms of the navigational pathways they work through in this resource. If they don't want to go to the content, they just can go to the tasks and attempt them and get RPL as well. Another resource we did some time ago for the Toolbox project in the business services area, frontline management called Upfront. Here, again, an authentic learning environment was created. And there are six case studies of managers within that company we have set up who are talking about the experiences, and activities are based on those experiences. Another toolbox, food safety, is set in a simulated company where all the tasks which students need to perform to learn about food safety competencies are based around what they'll do in the real world of work. Okay, another minute and I'll be done. Events Alive is a toolbox we did last year, again using authentic settings. So just to finish off, what are some of the shifts we are making in our learning design approaches? We are moving towards more multimedia based assets which capture skills in the real workplace and building learning around that. We are moving away from creating reams and reams of content, which we used to do in the past because there was a need for it as we were servicing distance education. We are also now moving towards greater content sourcing. We don't create content if it's already out there. We source it, we organize it, we tag it so that it's easily discoverable by teachers. We are moving more into interactive activities, which don't need programming skills. We've built about 20 learning activity wizards, which not only are learning designers, but also teachers in debt can use freely to create their own activities. We're also moving towards fitness for purpose notions of quality. So we're not looking at high production values in all our developments, but quality is judged by the teacher, what can support the teaching and learning out in the coalface. We also are increasingly integrating Web 2 tools in our learning designs. And I've got numerous examples which I can show later on. And just to finish up, we also are now building resources which can be used in standards-compliant learning management systems. All our content is packaged to IMS standards, so they can be deployed in those environments. And we are also building in capability within our resource delivery packages, so teachers can take that resource and grow it with the use of tools and templates. So basically, that's our approach. Yeah, I'll finish there.
That's great. Thank you, Vijendra. I'll just ask Richard Stubley to lay his presentation, and we'll move through that. You might like to be thinking about any questions you want to ask or points you want to raise as we get organised here. As I mentioned earlier, Richard is involved with OpenLearn. It's a company that specialises in open learning products, e-learning products. And I think he's about right. Thank you, Kath.
Oh, hang on. Okay, that's great. Thanks very much. Yes, I'm from OpenLearn, and we're an e-learning consultancy, so we design and develop content. Some of you may have seen a few examples out on the stall. We haven't so far worked with the VET sector, but we'd be very interested to do so. Our clients are in the corporate and government sectors. So I'm just going to show you one slide, which outlines our design principles. But more and more, I think we're going to move towards Cathy's approach and just be as really solid, concrete results orientated as possible. So it's a good discipline, even if we can't always achieve that. Partly due to sort of client constraints, that's our aim. And then I'd like to show a couple of quick demos, and this is also an opportunity for me to, on the path of self-improvement, to receive feedback, hopefully not too many tomatoes, and be able to move forward and improve. Demos are sort of higher production values, I'd say, but increasingly we're being asked to move more towards using rapid tools such as Articulate and Lectora and Captivate, which provide more cost-effective solutions and with good design are still very effective. So without further ado... The icons have all moved around now. Really, it's a learner, just preempting, it's a learner-centred approach. So we have in our bag of tricks, many adult learning principles. As long as they all revolve I'll move past that one. As long as they revolve around the learner, then that's what matters. And I think, to be honest, after a few years of practicing instructional design, we kind of move or work through instinct to some degree, that there are various principles, learning theories, and we select those that are most appropriate. Learning objectives is our foundation. I'm sort of having a few doubts about that now. Maybe we should be focusing on actions. I mean, if objectives do enable the learner to achieve the right actions, then that's great. Actions are behavior-based, so yeah, we're just mindful of the need to ensure they're performance-related. The motivation factor is a really big one for us. I think out of all of these, this is often what we really focus on. In the first demo, we'll show the use of a metaphor, which worked really well for this topic, and sort of reduce cognitive dissonance, as it can be called, or the gap between what is new and what the learner already knows. So it's bridging that gap. Use of a reward is motivating, of course. There's a small game in the first demo which helps to provide a reward. And then we have constructivist learning, cognitive learning, situated learning theories that we incorporate, use of authentic resources, and use a virtual expert very often, who should provide rich feedback according to the learner's decisions and actions. So I'll just move into the first demo. The first demo is a course we did for IAG. For part of the business, it was an orientation, but it's really a process course. It's a part of IAG that invents and develops new insurance products. And traditionally, they've kind of worked in silos. So one part will look at what's involved in claims, another will look at underwriting, another part will look at, I don't know, what else, insurance, you know, where it fits into their suite of products, that kind of thing. But they wanted new starters to be across all the various aspects and know where to go find out the information they needed to help them build an insurance product, if that makes sense. So, you know, they have an idea for a product, and then they may need to go and talk to the claims people to see what likely claims are being made and how that would affect the product. And those are the resources they go to. So we use a metaphor in this. As the overall approach, we thought a mad professor in a science lab was kind of appropriate because it's all about inventing. And you'll see that the metaphor we're using is a blueprint, which he uses for his invention, which is a jetpack, of course, and how that blueprint can equate to the concept of a new insurance product. So I'll just start that one up if I can find it. Hopefully this sounds okay.
Hello, and welcome to Personal Insurance Product and Underwriting. It's and welcome to my lab. I'm the professor, and I've just made a brilliant invention. It's called a jetpack, and it looks just like this. People love it and want to buy it. The only problem is that they can't insure it. And this is where you come in. You're going to help Personal Insurance build a new insurance product so that people can be insured when flying the jetpack. And look at the things in my lab. You can see the five stages of development that my jetpack went through. They're called concept and validation, product development, testing, product launch and ongoing development. When you manufacture a new PI insurance product or change an existing one, you'll follow the same stages.
So I'll just go into the menu so that we could just keep moving along through it.
VersaLab is your menu for progressing through the course. Please click on any of the stages to find out what happens.
So look at concept validation.
My jetpack is all the rage right now. But to get to that point, I first researched what people would really like to buy. I initially came up with a concept or blueprint, and then I started manufacturing it. And like my blueprint, the first stage of making a PI product is called concept and validation. Suppose you've just been told the PI executive wants a new insurance product. What factors do you think you need to consider at the concept and validation stage? Type some ideas that come to mind. For example, customers. Then compare your answers with ours.
So you can type in anything you like at all. I'm just guessing. So this is just getting you into the way of thinking and what might be involved. Now, what I'll do next is, you see, though the idea was that this was a creative approach, but the course is still highly structured, and the feedback we got was that good structure was appreciated. So at the moment, we're in the scenario section. We'll go into the activity section. While they're in the scenario section, they're told more and interactively about that stage, for example, concept and development, and they get to look at the resources that they need to use at this stage, for example, claims, underwriting, those areas, and how then the knowledge of the people in those areas applies to concepts and validation. Anyway, so now, having gone through that, we move into the activity area, and we try to make the activity as real to the work situation as we could.
You've seen what occurs in the concept and validation stage, and you've used the resources. Here are some typical questions you ask at this stage. Which resource will you use for each question? Click on the jetpack icon at any time if you'd like to check the resources you'd use.
So we ask the client, you know, what does the learner actually need to do at the concept of validation stage? And these are the questions that they gave us, but they need to know where to go. So, for example, we might start answering. So have customers been asking for this product? Maybe the intranet, maybe not. What do our competitors do with this type of product? Maybe sales and service. But maybe we're a bit unsure about some of the resources, so we'll click on the jetpack icon and go and check those resources. So here we can go and check on anything we need.
Claims and assessing can give us data relating to claims for any similar products. The proposed jetpack product is similar to the existing hoverboard product. Here is an extract from the business case that deals with claims.
And so on. You can work your way through all of those resources that are needed as you invent the product. So we'll close that now. And then, so we've looked at the scenario, we've been through an activity, and each stage has different types of activities. And because this is an orientation course, we thought it would also be good to hear from people who work in that area of IIG, which is a huge group, but, you know, in product and underwriting, as it's called. So we got some actual comments from people who work there.
Click on each question and get an insight from a team member.
So what's the best bit about being part of concept validation? Is it exciting to be in at the ground floor, et cetera, et cetera? So each stage has comments from different people who work in the appropriate area. Finally, see, I was prepared for 15 or 20. Oh, well. Can I just, I mean, there was another demo as well. The best bit is actually the summary, which you might think is boring, but we built the game into this. Does that include setting up time?
Here is a summary of what happens at stage one of the product manufacturing process. Just as I produced a blueprint for my jetpack, you need to develop a concept.
Right, so there's a summary.
You are building your own jetpack. This is what it looks like so far. And here is the amount of fuel that you have earned in this section. You'll need this for the big trip at the end.
So according to how well you did in the activity, so you'll build something, add to your jetpack, maybe go faster stripes or additions. And you'll also earn fuel. And at the end of the whole course, when you've been through all the activities, you'll click a takeoff button and then you'll fly to somewhere in the world. And the more fuel you've got, the further you'll go. So the ultimate destination is Paris. If you didn't do so well, it's Dubbo, I'm afraid.
It's around
one, I guess. Dubbo's a fine place. I know, it's fine. It's fine.
Thank you very much, Richard. Yes? Thank Richard and Vijendra for being brave enough to set the scene for us a bit. I guess the critical thing in my mind that those demonstrations indicate is that the difference in context that e-learning designers are working in relation to vocational education and training. So I was just wondering if I maybe could start things and ask Kathy, what she thinks the significance might be of us trying to operate in a competency-based training system in Australia, and whether that leads towards resources that might tackle things from the kind of approach that she's argued for since she's been here, or whether, you know, that creates other problems that that we might have to struggle with.
Let me take this off. So the question was, how does the fact that you're having to meet certain competencies that have already been predefined? I think actually, when I first looked at your materials, when I was first looking at this whole prospect of going around Australia, I thought, hey, they know how to write performance objectives, because those competencies are phrased as behaviors that have to happen in the real world, at least the ones that I've seen. And so in that respect, you're ahead of a lot of people who are focused more on learning objectives, and they get sucked into the defining what people need to know thing, where you're given a list of things that people have to do. And so that's a good focusing situation.
But most of the things we've talked about over these couple of days have really related to resources that are about e-learning and asynchronous situations with structured e-learning arrangements, or that are corporate-based, rather than the kind of struggle to develop resources for the broader vet sector, which, you know, might engage many of the people in this room. Do you think your kind of approach can be used for that broader sort of resource rather than the narrower?
Well, I think that any resource, no matter, I mean, if we're talking about a 45-minute asynchronous standalone corporate thing, or a semester-long multi-modular facilitated course, the same principles apply. We're trying to change people's behavior in the real world, or give them the skills that they're going to need when they get into the real world, if they're preparing for that. So I think that the same principles apply, and that the more realistic and the more contextual, you know, realistically contextual we can make our activities, the better off the learners are going to be.
What do other people think? How have you reacted to the kinds of discussions that have been going on
compared to the work that you deal with each day.
Any questions? Yep.
I'm just interested, I wasn't here yesterday, so I'm not sure if they covered that sort of thing yesterday, but just a couple of examples that were up there then, and I've looked at other, I teach in a trade area, so I've looked at other like learning toolboxes in those areas and stuff, and I find a lot of the ones, like the second one that just presented, it's aimed really juvenile-like if in the setup, more than work-based sort of related or sort of real-life related. I just wondered, is there other people that are, and the first gentleman was from a development company, but are there people that are more like away from that school age sort of juvenile concept and more into like a real activity sort of thing?
Okay, might let Richard respond to that first, seeing it's his resource that you're referring to, and Vijendra might want to also make some comments, and then I'll ask Kathy if she wants to say something about that.
Well, fair comment. Yes, maybe it is juvenile. But
I think the derogatory thing was just a general observation. Like, okay.
One concern is to make the experience engaging for the user. And even fun, that's actually allowed in the learning as well. So that's what we try and achieve. And if that's through characters and a bit of humour, then we actually find that's well received.
In terms of the learning environments we design, we often get real people to actually share the experiences. If you look at the Events Alive toolbox I flashed up, that will have examples of people working in the real world of work to do with events management. Also in our learning resources, we have optional pathways. Those who don't want to go to the simulated company, they can do the same activities and tasks in their real workplace. For example, if they're already working in a child care center, they don't need to go to Somerville. They can do the same activities in their own center.
Kathy, do you want to say anything about any of that?
I agree that the use of humor and fun characters adds a lot. And I think that it might, and for some audiences, it might be best to make those fun characters in a sort of a realistic workplace. I think the metaphor thing works for some audiences, and for other audiences, I think just put some funny characters in a workplace and make the activity, the exercise, from beginning to end, something that you're working on. You can do humor, basically, without being dry and realistic.
Seems like a reasonable point. Can I just ask other people in the room, are you increasingly, as Vijendra's saying, increasingly using real workplaces rather than creating things, or are you using that other kind of approach? People nodded. Someone say something?
We tend to use real workplaces too. I think probably early in my career, having created a metaphoric environment and got the feedback from somebody that said, look, I felt like I was reading a kid's storybook and I really just wanted to get to the point. And so we've probably gone a little bit more to the dry environment, but and that's always a challenge to keep it engaging but not patronising. And I think that we certainly do have some learners that would perceive a simulated or animated character as being a little bit patronising.
Dee from Beyond Edge. We produce quite a lot of content that is based in the real world, rather than animated characters as such. But I can understand that at times there is a budget constraint, and there are certain things that you can produce and design very quickly online, and then other times you do have sort of larger budgets where there's a lot of video and a lot of case studies that can be really explored in a really gritty, sort of more interesting way. But there are content developers, to answer the gentleman's question down there, content developers producing content in the real world, and we are one of those. And that's just a response to that question.
Thanks, Dee.
I have a question. How much does generation or cultural backgrounds have on developing these tools to make them acceptable to the audience you're dealing with? In other words, when you don't know who your audience is going to be and you're trying to develop materials, what do you have to keep in mind?
I would first really push hard to identify the audience more clearly, treat it as a marketing project where you really need to know who your audience is and what pushes their buttons. If you're told your audience is anybody who might possibly be interested in this topic, the question was, how do you deal with that, basically? I always try to go for humor, and that's even riskier. And so you try to find something, ideally you can talk to a representative sample of learners and bounce ideas off of them. One of my favorite projects was one in which we were supposed to teach a very dry technical subject it was literally thousands of people who worked for a big corporation. And it was supposed to be funny, and it was supposed to be funny to people in China, India, and the U.S. And so it was like reliving my marketing days, proposing ideas and having them shot down repeatedly. But we finally asked the client, what do your people find funny? What do your workers laugh at? And they thought about it for a minute, and they said, in every cubicle is a Dilbert cartoon. We are geeks, and we laugh at geeks, make fun of geeks. And then it was easy. So we made fun of geeks. We also had a poodle, because I had researched. I needed an animal for a certain activity, and I had to actually get online and research which animal is, like, least offensive around the world and considered funny. It was a poodle, yeah. So poodles are safe. Everybody, they loved the poodle. So I think it's safest to aim above the age range that you are thinking of. I think it's safer to err on the sophisticated, not sophisticated as in boring, but sophisticated as in sophisticated humor over visual humor. Sort of creative characters over stereotypes. And because that's more likely to be funny to everybody. Whereas if you're going a little lower, then you get people that say, for whatever reason, I don't like that. That's too young or whatever.
I can add a little bit to that one because I was recently involved in a project where we were getting some IT concepts or some safety IT concepts across to year 3 and some year 9 students right across Australia. And we did the build a robot concept. It worked beautifully for year 3, improved it for the year 9s and got slammed. Absolutely slammed. They said, that's too young for them. So we had to completely change the concept to a Triple J, for those that know Triple J, type of approach, and that worked beautifully. But, yeah, the robots went down like lead cement.
Yeah, I think the age differences are going to be more pronounced when you're dealing with a younger crowd.
I work for Corrective Services, and we had to take into account a range of factors, very low education levels to master's degrees, very low unemployment levels to high flyers. So we actually had to build a training package with facets to it. So where you had the ACT in its letter-for-letter term, where you had, they clicked a button, they went into layman's terms, including swear words, because that's the culture, where they would have narration, voiceovers, and animation, and reading, so to cover all aspects, including foreign languages, Arabic, Vietnamese, etc., all in the one package. You had to cater for the whole lot. In that sort of environment, you can't isolate. A commercial cleaning program I developed, for example, had to have all those aspects.
Sorry. Yeah, just having moved from education into the business sector this year, we've found it really exciting designing courses for staff and having the humour involved and the games where we can. And the issue is not the age, it's the relevance and it's the amount of time. So if people, they're busy people and they've got a job to do, but they want to, if they have to do learning as well, and if that learning is engaging and relevant, then they're really happy. And I've had people ring me up and say, my headphones aren't working and everybody's laughing at this training and I want to join in. And that's what you want to hear. So it's not definitely not the age thing. It's the relevance.
I just want to ask Kathy something, because from the two sessions that Kathy conducted, you focus a lot on the engaging in the learner's brain and to do what's in the real world. In the case of the vet sector that I worked in, we developed resources for TAFE Institute. So we are actually one step away from the teachers who are actually doing the delivery. And in terms of getting into the learner's brain, there's such a diversity of learners. The same content can go to, you know, 15 to 19-year-old, you know, trades, you know, they just started with their apprenticeship. Or it can go to mature age worker like the 45 to 60 because they want to upskills or have a different career. Or being delivered in a juvenile justice systems, you know, for people who are in prisons. So in terms of the learner's brain, you know, it's actually very different, even for the same content. My question is, are there two different levels of instructional design? One level is like resource developer like us. And then at another level is the level that actually dealing with the audience.
Yeah, it sounds like maybe you're talking about you're providing resources to the teachers who then need to be able to modify it to suit their audience because they're the ones that know the audience. And so I think there's an argument for the sort of agile, easily changed, not super high production value resources. So yeah, I would see that as sort of two levels in your case. You have providing the teachers with, hey, here's a good approach to use when doing this, you know, and here are some activities that we've written, and luckily we're delivering them in a format that's easy to edit so you can make them more appropriate to your audience. So you could do like example activities, I guess. I'm not sure. Because I think that if you're trying to provide something that's going to work for everybody, it's going to be the whole room temperature coffee situation. Yeah.
Can I maybe take that a bit further? I think the practice of e-learning here now very much indicates that blended learning is the norm rather than anything else. So in terms of how people are building their resources, how do they build for a blended learning environment as distinct from a structured online learning environment? And maybe Richard or Virendra might want to comment on that as well.
Well, I think you need to be involved at the beginning of the strategy that's being worked out for learning solutions, and be part of the decision making that looks at should we put this online or should it be in the classroom, so that the instructional designer has or could have, you know, valuable insights into which is more appropriate for in online and what's more appropriate for classroom. And maybe the more basic fact-based content could go online and the more people-based skills nurturing could go in the classroom. So.
I teach quite a bit online and none of it's static. And very little of it is, so probably I'll use bits of resources, but I'm forever changing for whoever I'm teaching, and it's live, and it's that interface between the student that I find valuable. So all that I'm hearing is too much of it just being, you know, just set and students not interacting with anyone else, and I just see it as so important that students, when they're learning, are interacting not only with the teacher, but with colleagues and other students as well, because they're getting... They're hearing what other students are asking or feeling uncomfortable with. They're feeling more comfortable themselves because they're trying to work out what it is. They're getting feedback from how the other students are interacting as well. So to me, I mean, I think we're just going in this one direction. We're looking at e-learning, whereas e-learning's a huge big world that can be asynchronous and synchronous, or say synchronous, or even asynchronous, but connecting in with other students, discussion forums, all sorts of voice threads, a whole host of things.
A couple of people here.
Just further to that whole notion of blended delivery, I believe that all e-learning really has to have a blended, you know, component to it, because in your overall organisational strategy for that particular course, you need to think about where the interactions are going to be, and when you've got an e-learning course that is, you know, it's just a one-way interaction, you've got to think about how you're going to engage your staff after, you know, that particular learning has been facilitated, because they're learning not just because you're telling them to, they're learning because they need to apply that information. And so some way of having peer learning be engaged after the learning on an e-learning basis is a really, really good idea. And we've had a couple of instances with clients where we have gone in and there has been a strategy already produced, but looking at from a content developer's perspective and your organization's perspective, where you fit in as e-learning people, is talking to the stakeholders and saying, right, what is it that you want to achieve, and then inserting e-learning as a part of the overall strategy, not that it's replacing any strategy, but it's something that is a component of. An example of a particular project that we did was engaging teams of people on knowledge that they need to know, and getting them to contribute to that knowledge as it sort of grows a library of information on particular ideas. So yeah, I really think that the blended approach is a really good way to go, and hard content that you need to have expressed is very well delivered e-learning, but you still need to have another plan for engaging people afterwards.
Kathy, do you want to respond to that at all?
Just very quickly, one good use for scenarios is to run a story to a certain decision point and then stop and then send everybody to discussion. So that's a good way to, if you're finding people aren't discussing very much, make it even more potentially controversial than it might be.
One of the shifts we have made over the last couple of years is from designing structured e-learning resources for a structured distance learning environment, which serviced about 35,000 distance students, to designing for blended learning. And our resources are very fluid. It has to be. I mean, learning in an online world is always learning from content which is changing, which is, in my view, always a beta version on the web. So if we are locking our resources, if we aren't making it flexible and growable and adaptable and enabling teachers to mix and match and put their own flavor and blending to it, we won't make it interesting enough for learners to learn from.
Thanks, Rajendra. That brings us to the end of the time that we had allocated this afternoon. So thank you, Kathy. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Rajendra.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melanie.
Thanks, Karen. And I just have a small presentation for our presenters. Richard, thank you very much. Thank you. And it was great to see your work, and thanks for sharing that with us. And I've got one for you, that's it. One for Rajendra, thank you. And one for Kathy, though I don't quite know what she's going to do with on the plane. She'll have to drink it tonight. Thanks very much, Kathy. And thanks to Karen too. I just couldn't carry four, so have to wait. But thanks very much, everyone, for participating. I really thank everybody and Karen for organising this.
Thank you, Mike.